Welcome to Conversations for a Brave New World with Donna, Sonia and Cliff, where we bring you a global, national and local focus on gender, sexuality and feminism.
Hey there, thank you for joining me. I'm Clifford Lewis and I'm an academic in the School of Business at Charles Sturt University. June is traditionally known as Pride Month in commemoration of the riots that took place at the Stonewall Inn in the United States on the 28th of June 1969. These riots perhaps marked for the first time a global and visible effort to raise awareness about the injustice LGBT people were experiencing. Since then, we've come a long way. Here in Australia, in 2017, we had legislation passed which enabled marriage between people of the same sex. This year, Sydney hosted World Pride. We saw perhaps one of the largest Sydney Mardi Gras parades and witnessed over 50,000 people marching across Australia's iconic Sydney Harbour Bridge in support for LGBT rights. However, at the same time, we also saw unrest from far-right movements, protesting against LGBT people, claiming that LGBT people were trying to convert children and destroy social values. So how far have we actually come? To discuss this question, I'm joined by Professor Noah Reisman, who is a professor of history and an LGBT historian at the Australian Catholic University. I'm also joined by Carl Sotowski, who was part of the movements following the first Mardi Gras in Sydney in 1978. Carl, you're part of a group called the 78ers, who are quite well known within the LGBT communities. Can you tell us who the 78ers are?
Well, the 78ers are those people who were involved in a series of protest actions during the second half of 1978. We fall into two groups: those who were activists who had been involved in gay liberation, as it was known, since the early 1970s, and who organised a series of events on the 24th of June 1978, which were known as the International Day of Solidarity. The second group, to which I belong, are people who became involved in protest activity in the months after the 24th of June. It was on the 24th of June, a parade down Oxford Street, which had been dubbed a Mardi Gras, was disrupted by police, and there were multiple arrests. And in the months after that, there was a campaign known as Drop the Charges, in which people like me became involved. And at having the charges dropped, and that campaign was successful.
Yes, it's not that long ago that homosexuality was considered a criminal act or a mental illness. Following the protest in 1978, the names of the people that were arrested were made public in local newspapers. This resulted in a lot of people losing their jobs, being evicted from their homes, and being discriminated against because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. So what happened in 1978?
In 1978, the events on the 24th of June were part of an International Day of Solidarity. And this was organised out of San Francisco. It was an international call that went out from San Francisco to liberation groups all over the world. And let me stress at this point that those groups are first world groups. This call went out calling on us to join with the US LGBTI gay liberation community in opposing some initiatives that were to be voted on in California. So we received in Sydney a letter, because there was no email in those days, a letter which is now known as the letter from San Francisco, calling on us to protest in solidarity. And actually, I recently came on a copy of this letter, and I'm just going to read out the final paragraph of it because I find it very, very moving. It says, "Imagine the positive impression millions of people marching peacefully and proudly for gay rights will have on world opinion. It sends shivers up the spine, because San Francisco sent out that call, and on the 24th of June, Sydney answered it with a series of protest marches. The police mishandled those protest marches. The event on the evening of the 24th of June turned into a riot in King's Cross. There were arrests, and an ongoing protest movement followed. And that movement, quite by accident in a way, really signals the beginning of a gay community in Sydney and further abroad in Australia generally, but a community as part of an international community.
Noah, your research looks at LGBT history, particularly focusing on the trans community. What got you interested in this field of research?
My original research area was the history of Indigenous people in the Australian Defence Force. And when I was doing a project on that, I wound up interviewing a gay Aboriginal ex-Air Force person. And he was willing to tell me off the record what it was like being gay in the Air Force, but he wouldn't tell me on the record. And around the same time that I did that interview, this was in 2012, and there was this tiny little article that appeared in the Star Observer about 20 years since the ban had been lifted on gay and lesbian people serving in the Australian Defence Force. So these sort of came together in my mind. I am also an openly gay man, and I sort of was thinking, you know, everyone's heard of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. A lot of people know more about the US than here. And so from there, I then got in touch with a few other LGBTIQ plus historians, and we put together a project looking at the history of LGBTIQ people in the Defense Force. While doing that project, I interviewed about a dozen trans members, past and present. And one thing that became really clear from that was you couldn't understand the experiences of trans people in one institution like the Defense Force without knowing the much broader contextual history. So the legal, the medical, the social, and that hadn't been done yet in Australia. So I approached a few trans friends and asked them what they thought about doing a history of trans people in Australia. And they said, absolutely, this is well overdue and we need this. So I then started a project on the history of trans people in Australia.
It is hard to separate out the social context when looking at a group that's often marginalized and how they respond to the environment. For those not familiar, trans people represent the T in LGBT, and ACORN, which is one of Australia's largest bodies on LGBT rights and health, explains that trans and gender diverse people are a population of people whose gender is different to what was presumed for them at birth. Noah, what have you noticed about trans rights over time?
Time magazine in 2014 referred to it as the trans tipping point, this sort of point in time where trans rights and trans visibility had come such a way that there seemed to be more people in favor of trans rights as there are against it. And I do think that that was accurate. But at the same time, as you've seen progress, you've seen this massive backlash, and this massive backlash attacking trans people's affirming healthcare, trying to stop the birth certificate reform, attacking trans children and young people, especially trans people in sport. And I think Australia, fortunately, that backlash, it's vocal, but they haven't gotten as much traction in legislation as they have in places like the United States and the UK, which is very worrying. But it's also a reminder that the gains of history cannot be taken for granted. Trans people and their allies need to consistently stand up for trans rights, fight for trans rights, which is exhausting. It's just exhausting for trans people to have to constantly do this.
So it sounds like while things are getting better in some ways, there are still many challenges that the trans community faces.
I think it actually is big picture getting better, but with the getting better is this really nasty backlash at the same time. So in legislation, things are getting better. Access to services, look, there's a ways to go and it's patchy, but there is a lot more doctors, for instance, now who are willing to provide affirming care than there have ever been before. And there's increasing numbers of that. There's more training modules. So I think it is getting better, but at the same time, you've got this really vocal, nasty backlash, perpetuated especially by right-wing politicians and the right-wing media, which is in people's faces constantly. So it doesn't always, I think, seem it's getting better. And I also say this knowing, like, A, I'm speaking from the privilege of a cis white guy who doesn't have to live with that backlash as a personal attack. And also, that's very visible. And when you see that day to day, I can understand it feeling like it's getting worse. Like, I can really see that. But then look at what happened when that transphobic person visited from overseas. That person was so outnumbered by trans allies and supporters and was, you know, basically booed out of Hobart, booed out of Auckland, New Zealand. They are losing, but they are really loud. And that doesn't make it any easier for trans people in the process.
Carl, as someone who's fought for LGBT rights since 1978, what changes are you seeing?
I've just got back from a protest here in Sydney against a group of right-wing Christians who are championing very old and overused slogans in protection of the family and saving of children, accusing LGBTI people of being pedophiles and abusers and molesters, and demanding that our rights be rolled back. Now, these are exactly the same challenges that we were opposing back in 1978. We are in exactly the same place now, 45 years later, where we are obliged to take action here in Sydney against groups who want to restrict the rights of trans kids in particular. Now, this is a new aspect of the movement, I have to say. Transphobia is a development of the last 10 to 15 years, but it is merely only a new manifestation of the old homophobia that we all suffered back in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. The right-wing extremists are essentially targeting the other that threatens their perception of their place in the world.
So it sounds like the only change has been that who's being targeted is different. While previously, gay and lesbian people would have borne a lot of the brunt, that focus is now shifting towards trans people. Noah, as a historian, what have you observed in this? Is this debate new?
All of the debates you hear about children and young people now, literally recycled debates from the 1970s in the United States, 1980s Britain under Thatcher, it is exactly the same. And that's all the more reason why gay and lesbian people especially should be standing with our trans siblings and fighting this sort of bullshit, pardon my French, because it's the exact same arguments that were used against us. And now they're being recycled against trans people because gay and lesbian people, for all intents and purposes, are much more accepted in society now.
But many would say that acceptance has come at a cost, as gay and lesbian people have molded themselves and their identities based on what's typically associated with heterosexuality. Carl, what are your thoughts about that? Are gay and lesbian people losing their unique sense of identity in this search for acceptance?
This is complex because all of the advances that we appear to have made over the last 40, 50 years have actually produced an environment which has run counter to the identity that many of us were attempting to develop and protect during the 70s, 80s, and 90s. There is in society today, in LGBTQI society, a degree of heteronormativity, to use an academic term, which threatens to extinguish the uniqueness of the culture that we were trying to actualize back in the last quarter of the last century. Essentially, what that means is that gay society has become straight. Now, an example of this would be the desire to enter into formal contracts of marriage. Back in the 70s, if you look at the photographs of rallies, you will see placards and banners calling for the end of the nuclear family. And this was part of the dream, because you see, the nuclear family, mum, dad, and two kids, was essentially the absolute embodiment of patriarchal oppression. And the nuclear family is what groups like Christian Lives Matter are trying to assert and protect. It's the same struggle is going on right now.
These challenges make it very difficult to be yourself and display your authentic self and identity to those trying to work out how do they come out, how do they share their authentic selves with their friends, their family, and people around them. Coming out is a very important part for any LGBT person, and there's a lot of research that talks about the health and well-being benefits for people who are able to come out because they're no longer living a dual life. Noah, what advice do you have for young LGBT people who are in the process of discovering themselves and coming out today?
Look, it's a hard one to generalize because, again, I acknowledge my privileges. Like, I come white, cis, from a family that was accepting. I wasn't sure if they would be, but they actually were, and I know not everyone has that. I mean, so I want my advice to be, like, be open, be free. You know, it's great, but I know that that doesn't apply to everyone, so I actually don't know what to say, to be honest. I think you need to, maybe the answer is you need to do what feels right for you. Maybe that's the answer, is you need to do what feels right for you. I do know it's cliche and it gets overused, but I do genuinely believe it gets better. I really do, both for individuals and historically. I do genuinely believe that. So I could say that as well. But yeah, I guess it's fundamentally be who you are and do what's most comfortable for you.
Thank you, Noah. And Carl, what about you as someone who has contributed to LGBT rights and the fight for LGBT rights in Australia? What advice would you give to young LGBT people today?
The advice I have is to reach out and bond with the various community support groups, and particularly with political and activist groups. Because there is inevitably, after all the years of success for our movement, a feeling amongst younger people that the battles have been won, and because they themselves are infinitely tolerant and accepting of diversity, that will automatically apply to them for the rest of their lives. Unfortunately, it won't. There will always be a time when you encounter homophobia or transphobia, and that time will be unexpected, and the actual instance of homophobia or transphobia that you encounter will be very subtle but profoundly wounding once you realise what has happened. And the only way to deal with that when it happens is to have a support network, a community to fall back on and to advise and back you up. And be visible. Don't let them push you back into the traditional closet.
Thank you, Carl. For those interested in knowing more about what happened in 1978, you can check out Voices from 1978, a book published by the First Mardi Gras Inc. and compiled by Carl. I'm now joined by my co-host, Dr. Donna Bridges. Donna, a lot of what Carl said about marriage equality and how marriage equality can equate to assimilation definitely rings true. In some ways, to be accepted into mainstream society, we've seen this time and time again, that minority groups need to give up things that make them unique, things that make them interesting. And perhaps this need to assimilate through marriage and through the institution of marriage is aligned with that. Personally, though, I'm quite pleased to be able to get married and to have the option to be able to get married and celebrate that institution like everyone else does, and also the dramas that go with that institution. What are your thoughts, Donna?
I'm pro-marriage equality too, Cliff. I think it's important that people have the choice. I'm absolutely tolerant of gays and lesbians who don't want to get married, as long as they understand that that's their view. So marriage is having your relationship validated by the state, but it also means that you get rights that you wouldn't have as a de facto couple, and you certainly wouldn't have as a couple who is considered against the mainstream. So if your partner had very religious parents, for instance, you might have some issues around visiting your partner in hospital. If their parents were seen as next of kin and you weren't being seen by the hospital as next of kin. And also there are issues with superannuation. So I think as gay and lesbians who get married, we are then protected by the state from other people's viewpoints. So it's a good thing.
So, yes, I think definitely marriage as an institution, given how inherent it is in our society and innate it is in our society, does provide that protection. And we are seeing that need for protection, particularly amongst our trans people, as both Carl and Noah alluded to. Recently, we saw Posy Parker come out to Australia and New Zealand, where she spoke about how trans women were not real women and has created this whole undercurrent of what being a woman really is. We also saw Catherine Deaves recently compare her anti-trans activism in many ways to standing up to the Holocaust. Thankfully, these are minority voices, and we did see Australian LGBT people and our allies stand up in support for us.
That's right. They shouted Posy Parker down at those rallies. And to liken standing up against gay rights to standing up against the Holocaust is to not have this issue in perspective. Trans people are not putting conservative people or religious people who don't agree with trans rights in concentration camps and killing them. So perhaps whilst there are big advancements in the acceptance of the transgender community, there are people that are feeling threatened. And we should try to understand their views so that we can work with them on that. They do appear to be making trans rights into a moral panic. And I agree with Carl that the same objections were once applied to gays and lesbians. So we have to be very careful about how out of hand these debates are getting.
The beautiful message Carl ended with is definitely something which, it'd be great to end on as well in terms of the importance of community. In my research, one of the things that I've seen time and time again is the beauty of the LGBT community in accepting people who are different and providing support and a place to go to, because navigating sexual orientation, navigating gender identity can often be really confusing.
Yeah, I agree, Cliff.
And you will be hosting our next show. Do you want to give us a little bit of a sneak peek about what we'll be listening to then?
Well, yes. Please join us next month. We're going to talk to our guests about women in film, the representation of gender in film. It's going to be fascinating. So please come along.
That'd be fantastic, given the impact film has on society. Thank you, Donna. And thank you for listening to us today. We'll catch you again, same time, same place next month.
Thanks for listening. This show is brought to you by the Gender Network. To get involved or find out more, simply Google the Gender Network at Charles Sturt.